This CKNW podcast is brought to you by Destination Toyota in Burnaby. Open all the time at burnabytoyota.ca.
Welcome back. The investigation is underway and the protests are continuing in Toronto following the death of an 18-year-old man with a knife who was shot by police on a city streetcar. The police officer who pulled the trigger has been suspended as the investigation continues. 18-year-old Sami Yateem was shot multiple times and hit with a taser after he appeared to refuse police commands to drop the knife. The video of the event appears to show the teenager cornered and alone on a streetcar that was surrounded by police officers. But does the video tell the whole story? The case has some people calling for cops to wear video cameras on their uniforms so they can get a clear view of police conduct. Let's talk about these issues now. I got two great guests for you. Paul Cook is the president of the Ontario Police Association of Chiefs of Police. Hey, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for being here. Brian Flippins is here, president of Integris Limited, a company that makes body-worn cameras. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for coming on, guys. Paul Cook, let me go to you first. As the head of the Association of Chiefs and Police in Toronto, what can you say about this shocking story?
I really can't comment in relation to the incident itself. It would be inappropriate for me to do so. Because it's under active criminal investigation as well as investigation by the province's special investigation.
What can you say generally about what people are saying?
Well, certainly people have raised the issue as to whether or not police officers should be wearing video. And on behalf of the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police, I can say that we would be supportive of this type of technology. There's a number of concerns, not the least of which is the cost associated to the equipments, the upfront cost, the maintenance, and then having the HR cost for people that would be filing and distributing this information as required to various bodies such as the criminal courts.
Okay, but since in this case we've got what appears to be a cell phone video of the situation that, you know, everyone has seen, everyone is talking about, wouldn't it be better if the officers at the scene had been equipped with body-worn video cameras, right? Then you'd have a close-up view of what actually happened.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. As police leaders in the province, we would be supportive of this type of technology being worn by our officers.
Yeah.
Our concerns are related to the ongoing costs and the human resource costs associated to sharing this information. If, in fact, our officers were deployed with this type of device, any time there was a criminal charge, all of the evidence that was captured on that video would be subject to disclosure.
Yeah, I know that this has been employed in other jurisdictions. In Edmonton, for example, I understand there's a pilot project underway. And Paul Cook, I wonder, do you think a police officer, if he knows that there's a camera attached to his uniform, would he change his behavior? Do you think, and when he's talking to a suspect or doing his job?
I don't know that it would change the behavior of the officer. It would certainly bring some clarity to the issue and eliminate the he said, she said type of argument. It would be of assistance to us in relation to false allegations of misconduct against our officers, and it would also be assistance, you know, to police leaders where you do have misconduct that would be captured on that video.
Okay, let me go to Brian Flippins from Integris Limited. Brian, how do these things work?
They're very, they're fairly straightforward. They're the one that we market from Reveal Media is about the size of a BlackBerry smartphone. It's a little thicker in shape. It's got an HD camera which is able to rotate vertically and horizontally. The camera, there's one switch on the side of it that turns it on, and there's one switch on the side of it that you can set it into the record mode. And it just records whatever the event is that the officer is seeing at the time.
How many police forces are using this type of technology?
Well, it's probably more widely used currently in the UK and Europe. The product was designed in the UK. And is well received over there, and is used throughout England. We have Edmonton Police is one. We know Calgary are using a unit. Victoria did a test. We've Amherstburg has done a test. We've had it up at Ottawa as well. And we've had it in Montreal. So those are ones where they've seen it and tested it out and have in some cases have deployed, in some cases they haven't as yet.
And what has been the result in those jurisdictions that have the technology? Has there been fewer incidents of police misconduct?
I can only go by the studies that are done, which are publicly provided. The study was I think the Victoria study promoted it and thought it had some positive effects. The ones in I know there was one I think in Glasgow or Edinburgh that was done a study, and it did show not necessarily a change in the officer's behavior, but it certainly changed the behavior of the individual being recorded. With ours, you have there's an LCD screen on it that shows the person being recorded, so they get instantaneous feedback in terms of what their emotions are and what they're doing. So the studies have indicated to us that that there was a change in behavior of the person being recorded. In addition, there's obviously a cost to the camera. In our case, the cost is for the camera. We provide the back end video management as part of the sale. What the reports have showed is that there's an efficiency issue with the officers in terms of the amount of reporting they have to do because they've now got video evidence, and also the amount of time spent in front of in courts and so on, you know, proving their case and again the video is the evidentiary data that's used and simplifies the issue.
Let me go back to Paul Cook for a minute. Paul, what do you think rank-and-file police officers would think about this technology? I mean, the cops are getting taking a lot of heat over this incident in Toronto and several others. I would imagine that maybe some police officers would think, you know, bring it on, you know, because we're sick of this. But then maybe some of them would say, this is an invasion of my privacy. I don't want it.
I think that would be a fair assessment. I think that you'd have kind of a mixed reaction from police officers. And, you know, the bottom line is if provincially this was legislated or if an individual police service decided to roll this out, then there wouldn't be an option for the police. And,
right.
You know, we just have to weigh the costs of this type of technology versus other technology that's out there that allows us to improve our service delivery and be accountable to the public that we serve. Certainly when you have a high-profile incident such as this, it can impact on public trust and confidence. As police chiefs, we certainly see some advantages of the technology, but are cognizant of the costs and weighing that against other technology that would also be of assistance to the police.
All right. Thank you for coming on, guys.
Okay, very good.
I appreciate it. That's Paul Cook. He's the president of the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police. Brian Flippance, he's with a company that makes these body-worn cameras. I say bring it on. I mean, if you have these body-worn cameras on the cops, I think it would eliminate a lot of the uncertainty and the guesswork about what happened. A lot of these incidents are filmed on the street by people passing by with their cell phones, which is fine. That's great. I mean, it's great that we have this video evidence when stuff like this happens. But if you have a camera up close, maybe you could get a lot clearer picture of exactly what went down. I wonder, though, if some people might think there is some kind of civil liberties issue here, there's a privacy issue, not only for the cop, but for the people who are being arrested by the cop. Do they want video of themselves out there? I think we should do it. Let's put these cameras on the cops. Phone me up and tell me what you think about it. Do you think that's the way we should go? 604-280-9898, toll free 1-877-399-9898, *9898 on your cell. Your calls in the view of a civil libertarian. Next. All right, welcome back. As the uproar continues over the streetcar shooting in Toronto, a lot of people saying it's time for all police officers to wear body-worn cameras so we know exactly what's going on. What do you think? Should cops be required to wear cameras on their uniform? 604-280-9898 is the number to call me. Tell me what you think. Let's go to Joseph Hickey, Executive Director of the Ontario Civil Liberties Association. Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for doing this. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, now, first I want to say that our association hasn't had a chance to study this in detail, and we don't have a formal position on body cams, but I'm happy to participate in the public debate and bring up some important questions that come to mind.
Okay. What are some questions?
Yeah, well, you see, the hottest points of violence in our society tend to be where the police are. And a lot of the violence is done by the police. So whenever you propose a plan where that violence is going to be videotaped, that's a good idea. But there have to be safeguards put in place so that when that video goes to court as evidence, there isn't a selection. So if there are five cops at the incident, you should get all five videos. It should be uninterrupted video. There should be guarantees about preserving the video for a long time, because lawsuits can come up years later, or they can last many years. Now, it's important because this is the point of contact or the clash between the judicial and police apparatus and the public. So it's essential video, but the public has to have access to it, and it should be seen as a public resource. And access to information law should allow access to this video.
So I should be able to file a Freedom of Information request and look at these videos?
Yeah, if the government's going to pay to produce video taken in public for our protection and for the good of society, then there's no reason that it should be bound by secrecy in any way.
Okay,
criteria should apply.
When you say that the video should be uninterrupted, these video cameras have got an on-off switch, right? So what are the rules? But do you know what the rules are in other jurisdictions that use this? I mean, are police officers, are these things running 24/7, or do the officers decide themselves when to switch the video camera on?
No, I'm not sure about the details of how it works in different areas, but I think one possible solution could be to have it turn on when officers leave their car. And we know that in some areas there are dashboard cameras in police cars. But that would be something that would need to be, I think, debated and considered for sure.
Okay, 604-280-9898 is the number to call. Let's see what people think. Greg, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Okay, this is the one thing that I guarantee will come up as a human right thing, especially if you put a camera on a police officer. A, they're going to say that the public can't see it right away because it has to be part of the official investigation. B, once they do see it, how do you know what's been blacked out? How do you know when the video actually started? You'll get the subtitles of what everybody's saying. You get to see everything unfold. And now if, in fact, somebody did file a Freedom of Information Act, all they're going to do is come back and say, oh, well, this is classified because it's still an ongoing investigation, or it has to be filed properly and you won't be able to see it. They are going to find too many ways to screw the public out of seeing exactly what happened. This is why you need to have people with their smartphones and things like that who are actually taking video of this, because cops can't be trusted for that. They're looking.
Well, you're not gonna stop people from taking cell phone videos, though.
Well, no, you're not. But you can't. I'm sorry, but I don't trust cops at all, and so I'm not gonna sit there and just hope that they're gonna show me the whole video.
Well, you know what? This might actually be good for the cops, actually, in a way too. I mean, it would provide a public safeguard against police brutality, I think. But what about if you get a guy, like you say you don't trust the cops, and that's fine. But quite often police officers are going to deal with very violent offenders or suspects, and it may not be the police officer's fault if there's a confrontation. So I think this could actually be a safeguard for the cop.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's true. But, I mean, in that respect, when you guys report on something, I mean, which videos are going to start saturating the media? The ones where the cops are out of line? Or the ones where, oh, cops look like heroes every single day and they can do no wrong. I mean, it's kind of a catch-22 here.
Okay, Joseph, what do you think?
Well, there is a flip side to this coin. And the police often consider, when you're a person with a camera, that you're a threat to them doing their work. And that's an attitude that needs to be changed, and there has to be training to change that. I mean, people get arrested for interfering with police work because they're standing there filming and they're obviously not intervening. And there can't be an asymmetry of rights between a member of the public and the police in terms of holding a camera. If the police want to interview you and ask you questions, there's no reason you can't be holding a video camera right in their faces. So even if someone is being accused of committing a crime, they can still go on and film anything.
Okay, so you're saying, let's say I get pulled over by a police officer or whatever when I'm driving my car, that I should be allowed to flip on my cell phone, start recording everything and holding it up, right?
Absolutely.
You say hold it up in front of the cop's face. What do you think a cop would say if I did that?
Oh, well, I think that should be you know, completely allowed. It should that evidence shouldn't be tampered with.
But what would the cop typically do in a case like that, do you think?
Well, I
think, the cop would say, stop filming, man, put your phone down.
Yeah, and that's not, they can't use that as a pretext to prevent an individual from filming. It's that individual's right to record their reality as they see it.
604-280-9898 Okay, 604-280-9898 is the number to call. Percy.
Yeah, Mike, well, previous caller took away a little bit of my thunder. I'd agree on every one of his points, but I'd also like to add, just getting back to the on-off switch. I mean, Think about that. How would you, like, what's Cobb going to do? He's let's just put him in an emergency situation. He's with his partner. Says, oh, Fred, did you turn the on button on the camera? Oh, no, did you? Geez, I don't know. And then when you've got all this video, you've got to log it, you've got to file it, you've got to put it somewhere. I mean, it's going to be, just an organizational nightmare just to figure out where everything's going to go. It's got to be secure. And, of course, they're going to use it selectively. They're not going to – I would say, you know, like it sounds good in theory, but it's one of those things that you try to put that in practice. Imagine every cop with a little camera that he's got to turn on before he goes out and confronts somebody. It ain't going to happen. I mean, and if it does, it's going to be
It's happened other places. You know, I mean, it's happening elsewhere. But, Joseph, what do you think about that? I mean, when you talk about sort of preservation of evidence and the duty for a police officer to keep notes and record what he's doing, I mean, does this just add another layer of bureaucracy to the system?
No, it's we should be in favor of cameras in that they're overall publicly accessible records of interactions between the police and society. And if personal videotaping can help create more transparency and less secrecy and break the code of silence of the police, then it can only be a good thing. Of course, individuals may have to fight to get that video, as they do with surveillance video. This is often the case. But it's better that it exists than not exists.
Okay, this incident in Toronto, man, this is going to get everyone talking on this issue for sure, and we'll see where it goes in the days ahead. I want to thank you for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
All right, that is Joseph Hickey, the Executive Director of the Ontario Civil Liberties Association. Phone me on the listener line. Tell me what you think about this. 604-331-2784, and we may play your call at the end of the show. All right, yesterday on the show, we talked about panhandlers. What do you do when a panhandler hits you up on the street for money? Do you give money or do you keep on walking? A lot of people said, why can't panhandlers just get a job? We'll talk about that next. All right, yesterday we got a big reaction on social media to our segment on panhandling. Do you give money to panhandlers or do you just keep on walking? A common sentiment from our listeners on the open line yesterday, why can't these people just go out and get a job? Are they lazy or what? I mean, some of them obviously look down and out. But others, I mean, you get hit up by a young guy who looks able-bodied, able to work. Why can't he just go out and get a job? Here is a sample of what people had to say yesterday on the open line.
For instance, right now, okay, I just pulled up to Wellington and Lougheed Highway. There's a guy here. He looks healthier and younger and fitter than me, and he's holding a sign saying, I need food money. You know, I'm walking up and down the center of the street. I'm not going to give somebody like that money. Get out and get a job. That's what I'm doing. There's lots of work out there to be found. Go on a construction site, you can find work. But when I pull up to, you know, or I see somebody sitting at outside and they're disabled or they're elderly and you know they're messed up, you know that it's not that easy for them to find work, I will give them change. I will help them out. I mean, I've tossed, you know, $5-$10 sometimes into a hat for a guy who's, you can tell he's down on his luck.
I live in Kelowna here and I'm inundated every day. They stand in the middle of the median at the traffic light.
Yeah.
This one guy had a sign, I need to buy dog food, but there was no dog around. And it's crazy. I just tell him to go to the orchard. They can make $100 a day easily.
Yeah, it's hard work.
Yeah, but it's crazy. They're all young and able-bodied.
One time I was accosted by a panhandler, and they're asking for money for food. And I told them that there was a employment center just a block away that was having a free barbecue, offering free food to everyone. So I directed them to that, and they're like, no thanks. So I do not give change to panhandlers, especially, like you said, ones that look young and able that can go get a job. But I will give occasionally, a bag of chips if I have some spare food on me. I'll give them some food.
Okay, there you go. That's what people had to say yesterday, and you see that recurring theme, right? Some of these people look young, fit, able-bodied, and able to work, so why would you give them money? Is there something maybe we don't know about these people? You can't judge a book by their by its cover, goes the old saying. Let's get the other side of the story now. Chantel Krish is the manager of advocacy and public relations at the YWCA. Chantel.
Hi there.
Thanks a lot for coming on. And Jonathan Hayes is the Employment Services Manager at WorkBC Employment Services Center. That's in Vancouver South. Jonathan.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks a lot for coming on, guys. Chantel, let me go to you first. What do you think about when you hear this, when you hear people say, oh, you know, this guy can get a job. Why is he out panhandling? I mean, are there some situations where someone who may look like they're fit and able to work really can't?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think, first of all, I appreciate that we're on the program talking about the other side because I do think that that's very important. Homeless people in Vancouver, they're faced with numerous barriers when they're trying to find work, such as access to affordable housing, lack of social support, being stuck in the cycle of poverty, mental health issues, and just general challenges in getting job ready. So it's not really that simple. First and foremost, without a permanent address, it's really difficult for anyone to find sustainable employment. And so in a city like Vancouver, that can be exceptionally challenging. And so there are a number of layers that exist between actually getting off of the street and being able to find meaningful employment. And it's important that we examine those and try to address some of those systemic issues so that we can successfully help the people that are living on the streets of our city.
Okay, what does job ready mean?
Job ready means pretty much you're ready to go to and seek out full and have full-time employment. You know, that job ready, and let me just step back a little bit.
Yeah.
When it comes to the homeless youth, for example, those who are willing and able-bodied, when they come into one of our WorkBC centers, it's really about, and we find out that they're homeless, it's really about getting them job search ready before even thinking about being job ready. Now, job search ready means linking them, as Chantel said, to housing, linking them to other supports, food supports. You know, without that personal private space to be able to get up in the morning, to even wake up in the morning or the evening, to have an alarm clock, for example, to be able to shower, to have clothing, to look presentable at a job site, and to be well rested. You know, a lot of these homeless individuals out there are suffering from sleep deprivation. You know, they're sleeping in public spaces, they're not sleeping in their own private space. So we really have to think about that in terms of getting them ready, getting them life ready, you know, ready for a new life of full-time or, you know, part-time employment. And then we can think about, let's look at resume writing. Let's look at how to develop your job interview skills. You know, you have to examine, first of all, housing. There could be an addiction issue. Many of these youth, you know, and just stepping back a little bit, many of these youth who are willing and able-bodied are also, the vast majority of them have witnessed or experienced abuse in their life. So we have to really think about, okay, you know, they may look willing and able-bodied, but what else is going on as well? And that's where our career advisors come into play, to identify those needs and to refer them to youth housing. For example, the YWCA works with Covenant House downtown here at our downtown youth satellite office. And we connect them to those different sources, you know, food, for example, or, you know, if they need to work on a site and first aid is required, we can get them that first aid training. But first of all, they need the housing.
Okay, Chantel, when people come in and they're looking for work, I mean, you know, I think these services that Jonathan was describing are important. And the best thing I think we can do for people who are in this situation is transition them into some kind of a job. You know, like make them productive members of society. I mean, have you seen success stories where someone who is, say, homeless comes in, gets some help, and actually can turn their life around, get a job?
Certainly we have. And I think that the reason that we see success stories like that, and Jonathan can speak to some specific examples, but is because we're providing a range of holistic services. So it's not just getting them off the street and into a computer so that they can work on their resume, but it is providing them with access to housing, with access to clean clothing, with access to some counseling support and a range of services, maybe getting them on income assistance so that they can actually set up a phone line or setting them up with a system.
But why would they even want to work, though, if they can get all that without working?
Well, it's going to be really difficult to sustain a job if they aren't in a position to actually have a house, a roof over their head, proper nutrition, proper sleep, all the supports that are in place that are needed to sustain meaningful employment. And so they're not necessarily looking for handouts. It's more yeah. about setting them up to be successful in their lives.
Okay. You know, Jonathan, like yes. one of the things we heard on the open line yesterday was a lot of people will say, look, I will see people on the street and I know that this person is down and out. They're an elderly person. They're disabled. It's obvious, right? But
right.
then others look like, wait a minute, can this guy work? Is this guy trying to scam me? I don't know. It's tough to tell sometimes. For the people that you deal with at your job, I mean, do you ever see anyone come in and you think in the back of your mind, come on, this guy can work. This guy can get a job. Or do you think everybody who comes to see you is legitimately struggling?
Well, it's important to remember, Mike, that at our employment services division, we serve anybody who comes in the door. We do not yeah. pass. We cannot pass judgment on them because and I guess it's because I'm used to working in an environment where I see people from all walks of life, and I've seen people who you could very well easily pass judgment on them, and then you find out, wait a minute, here's a success story in the waiting. Here's something that's going to be incredible. We always and the career advisors always think about that you know what, this person has potential. You know, this person can really, they come in, and I'll give you an example. A homeless youth came into our downtown youth satellite office and had the audacity to say, in our preconceived notion that, you know what, I want to set up an IT services business. Okay, you're homeless, all right. So the career advisor met with him, and he went through the steps, getting him connected to Covenant House, getting him connected to food. And this guy ended up being a real go-getter. And he ended up going through the process, developing those life skills first, getting small temporary part-time positions to save up money so he could set up his own business. Right now, Mike, he is working in downtown Vancouver, serving businesses with an IT services wow. provider business. He is a success story. And not everybody is a point A to point B, boom, here's a great success, right?
Right.
Not everybody has their own path in life. And sometimes it's point A to point Z to point Q and then back to point B, every individual must be treated as such,
okay.
and that's how we treat them.
Okay, I'll jump in there, guys. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more with Chantel Krish and Jonathan Hayes. Let's get some more phone calls going on this. What do you think about what you're hearing? We got quite a reaction to the segment yesterday. Phone me up. Tell me what you think. Do you think there are people panhandling on the street that could just easily get a job? Or do you think, like what Jonathan said, look, you can't judge a book by its cover. You don't know what these people have been through in their life, and they need help. 604-280-9898 is the number to call, toll free, 1-877-399-9898, *9898 on your cell. Your call's next. All right, taking your calls and panhandling, 604-280-9898 is the number to call, *9898 on your cell. My guests are Chantel Krish and Jonathan Hayes. Let's go to your calls. Hey, John.
Call *9898 on your cell.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
You know what? They should do like they did in Vegas. They should make it panhandling illegal. Because here, about a year ago, downtown, I was at Main and Terminal, and a guy came up to me with a squeegee. He asked me for money, and I said, no, I don't have any money. And then he went up to the back of my car with a squeegee, and he scratched my paint.
Oh.
And ICBC said I had to pay the deductible on my paint because of what the guy did. I chased him down the street, and he took off. And, these people got us by hostage. Like, we're hostages by these panhandlers and poor people. And the government, nobody does anything about it.
Okay, did you say panhandling is illegal where? In Vegas, did you say?
Yeah, in Vegas. It's illegal. You can't panhandle for money in Vegas.
Okay, Jonathan, what do you think about that?
Well, I really can't speak to that individual incident that occurred with John there, but I really think that we are we do have services available, and as I've said before, I'll keep hitting it home, but housing is vital, and the more housing stock we have available to these individuals, the less I would say logically, the less we would see of panhandlers, because they're getting the supports in place to be successful individuals contributing to the economy of British Columbia.
Okay, but for someone, Chantel, let me go back to you. For someone who's out there panhandling, I mean, we do have an aggressive panhandling law in British Columbia. So what that guy just did to John that he just described, I mean, that's against the law. I mean, that's property damage. Nobody's going to condone that. But there is an anti-aggressive panhandling law in British Columbia. But do you think, I mean, the people you deal with, are most of them out in the, are most of them panhandling on the street?
Actually, no. Like, most of the people that we deal with are accessing our range of services. And, you know, it's interesting because it is unfortunate that those kinds of experiences occur. But truthfully, Vancouver has one of the highest poverty rates in the country. And so the systemic issues that we're seeing and resulting from are people trapped in the cycle of poverty. And so we need to actually look at, you know, what are the causes of some of those things. And, of course, we've mentioned housing. We've mentioned sustainable employment, childcare. I mean, there's a range of other issues there. And so it is important to look at those things a little bit more critically as well.
Okay, 604-280-9898 is the number. Let's go to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying people got to quit excuses for these people.
Say that again?
People have to quit making excuses for these people.
Okay, what kind of excuses?
Well, you know, they're saying that they're uneducated. Well, I'm...
Sorry, what? Anyway, Jonathan, making excuses for people.
Well, you know, I can make an excuse for myself, right? You know, I really don't think that we are trying to make excuses for people. When a potential client comes into our site, we have to assess what their needs are. So we're not there to make excuses for them. We also at our Employment Services Center, we also believe that it also comes to a point where they have to go out there and look for jobs too, right? You know, so there is, it can't just be us holding their hand every step of the way. They do have to show initiative at a certain point, right? You know, but at the beginning, you know, we really have to make those assessments first and be very critical about that and look at it from a very educated standpoint. Educated meaning really beginning to understand why this individual is coming in, why are they homeless, and going from there.
How busy is your office these days? I mean, is there a lot of demand there?
There is a huge demand right now. Yeah. And our downtown site, at our U Satellite office, for example, there's a significant chunk of people who are coming in who are homeless.
And yet I remember a program in the downtown east side called Pathways that I believe was federally funded program. And some of those funds were cut. So, I mean, it sounded like they were providing some of the services that you were providing. And yet, you know, funding is tight,
right?
So, I mean, do you think the problem is getting, Chantel, do you think the problem is getting worse?
Actually, I think that recently we've made a shift from a federal funding model to a provincial one. And so that out of that came the WorkBC Employment Services Center model. And so these WorkBC centers are all across our province, and it gives people the opportunity to either stop in downtown Vancouver or stop in Kamloops and receive the same level of service and have a case file that's actually consistent throughout the province. And so I wouldn't say that things are getting tighter. I'm seeing the province make an effort to really try and engage people that are underemployed or unemployed and to find opportunities where we can serve them. And so I think that, you know, as what we're seeing now is a lot of collaboration between provincial governments, between municipal bodies, between nonprofit organizations like ours and like organizations like Pathways and Covenant House and areas where we're all trying to work together to serve our most vulnerable people. And so I think British Columbia is actually doing a really good job.
And Mike, if I may interject here, I just wanted to say that at all our sites, we have we are in a cross collaborative mode. And I will say that in terms of we have people who have a disabilities background coming in from a different organization. We have, and they're all working together on site.
Okay.
So when we get together, we can collaborate and somebody says, hey, you know what? I have an idea for this. So in the past, you know, we previously had some of those federally funded programs, but right now we're actually working more collaboratively and really working together to really figure out how can we solve this particular issue.
Okay, let's take one more break and keep phoning me up on this. 604-280-9898 is the number to call, *9898 on your cell phone. Take a break, back with more of your calls after this. All right, welcome back. More of your calls, 604-280-9898. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning. I just wanted to say as a woman, I really don't feel safe when I'm approached by many of these panhandlers. I have to concur with the previous caller who said he was he experienced an aggressive panhandler. I've had that where I've had people spit at me. So, you know what, I think it should be illegal 100% in the city. While I sympathize with their plight, there is plenty of resources in our society that can support these individuals. Panhandling is a way for them to make extra money. I don't agree with it at all, and I think my safety is just as important as their, even more important than their ability to panhandle. And I think it should be illegal, 100%.
Where does this happen to you?
Cassiar and Hastings.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So, you know, you're in a position where you're in your vehicle, you're stuck between two vehicles. Somebody makes an aggressive attack at you, whether they spit at you or throw something at you. It has happened to me, and I resent that. I should be safe in my vehicle, and there's nowhere for me to go. So
someone spit at you when you were in your car.
Yeah. It wasn't the normal guy. It was another individual. I guess the normal guy. There was another guy. He's always there. He waves and things. I don't like to support that because I know that there's systems there, and I support other charities that support, like, the food bank and things
yeah.
like that.
Okay, Cheryl, thanks for calling in. A lot of people said that yesterday on the phone, too. It's like, okay, I'm not going to give money to someone on the street because who knows where that's going to go. Maybe it's going to fuel a drug or alcohol addiction. I'd prefer to give money to a frontline charity, and that way I know that it's going to help someone. Let's go to Sing on the open line. Hi, Sing.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say there's no shortage of work out there. There's plenty of labor work. There's, like, berry picking. There's farmers looking for people to work on their berry farms. There's people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s working out there 12 hours a day, and there's not enough work out there. And these guys will even go to pick up anybody willing to work on the farm.
Okay, Jonathan, can people get that kind of job?
Well, I mean, the what we really have to think about is, you know, yes, people can get that type of job, but we have to think about, are they going to be effective contributors to that particular business? When they have no sleep, when they are on suffering from a particular addiction, would that become a liability for the business? They have to think about that as well.
Yeah, but I hear this all the time, though, right? I mean, there are some businesses where there are shortages.
Yes.
Right. I mean, are there jobs out there? I mean, if someone comes in to your office and they've got their act together, and they're able-bodied, able-minded, and they're willing and able to work, can you get them a job?
We absolutely can. We provide them with that. They have to have the initiative to come in, first of all, and then we get them set up so that their resumes are in good order, their job interview skills are in order, and then they go out and they can apply for those positions, and we assist them. But that, you know, at the same time, the onus is on them at the end of the day to go to the job interview and work it out from there, right? But absolutely, if they are willing and able and ready to go and they aren't suffering from any addictions, and it's a fairly clean slate, then yes, absolutely. And we provide those services at many sites across the Lower Mainland.
And Mike, I just want to interject there
yeah.
too, because we have a center on the downtown east side of Vancouver at Princess and Hastings called Crabtree Corner. And so this is a full family resource center where we have everything from housing to medical care to free meals to programming. And so a lot of the people, and it serves primarily women and children because we are a women serving organization after all, right? Aside from our employment programs and our youth programs, of course. And so a lot of the people that end up working there have come from the street, have been homeless. And so once they've had access to these services, they've had access to housing, they've been able to get clean, they've been able to provide, we've been able to provide them with legal support and some basic education and skills training, they've worked there for 10, 20, 30 years. And they've gone on to become really active members in their community and give back to their community. And so it's these kinds of models that actually work to sustain people within the community and actually go on to lead happy lives. And
okay.
So we're really proud of that.
Thank you guys for coming on with the other side of it. I appreciate it a lot. That is Chantel Krish from the YWCA of Metro Vancouver, Jonathan Hayes from WorkBC. Phone me on the open line if you didn't get through, 604-331-2784. The View from BC is up next. Look south of the border at the continuing Anthony Weiner saga. That's next.